Michael Hughes is the latest in my series of nostalgia interviewees. My name is Chris Deasy. Michael works in the English Language and Linguistics Department at the University of Kent, and he tells us how what once started out as a two-week job ended up being one that has lasted for a quarter of a century. Now, Michael knew from the age of 10 that he wanted to be a teacher. He talks about his working-class background, where money was tight. He grew up in Guernsey, in proximity to Nazi bunkers and mines from the Second World War. He remembers watching the first ever Doctor Who episode. This is one of those wow moments. He watched it in 1963 with William Hartnell as the Doctor. And we discuss a shared love of radio. Listen with Mother was a particular influence that Michael remembers from when he was young. He talks about also Saturday morning cliffhanger cinema. After doing a B.Ed., Michael returned to teach at his old school. We find out that it perhaps wasn't the best of experiences. We discover what happened when Michael then tried to change direction, ultimately leading to his decision to train as an English language teacher and the serendipitous events that followed. Then towards the end of the interview, we discuss the nostalgia-invoking power of music. Michael loves going around cathedrals and old chapels, and he loves experiencing the recording of live broadcasts of choral evensong. We talk about the impact of social media in our lives, and then actually Michael gives us quite a surprise answer to the question at the end as to whether he considers himself to be a looking forward or a looking back type of person. So join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. My guest this week is Michael Hughes. And I am with Michael Hughes for this week's interview. We were just talking, Michael, about how this should be a sort of Desert Island Discs, albeit without the discs. But if you want to bring your
discs.
Yeah, but you can bring your records in. Maybe I'll edit them in afterwards if I get the copyright permission, but there might be a few years down the line for that. But anyway, it's wonderful to interview you. And I was just thinking that I think I met you really early on when I moved to Kent, because I came here in 2004 and you were doing lots of learning and teaching work in SECL at the time.
I was, yeah. I came here in 1994, but actually not as part of university staff. So I was employed, as it were, by an agency, albeit a very good one, because it was Hilderstone College in Broadstairs who at that time recruited staff to what was called the English Language Unit. I don't think the university wanted to get involved too heavily in employing English language teachers. So I think they had two English language teachers employed by the university and a director of the unit at that time. And I was brought in just to cover for somebody who'd had a family bereavement and thought he'd be away for 2 weeks. He was recruited for a special course, and here I am. So I came for 2 weeks, and 20-odd years later, 24 years later, I'm still here, just about.
Well, I'm sure we can always come on to that. But this is the thing that I found throughout the interviews, how unusual or surprising to the interviewees themselves it is that they are in this profession.
Yeah.
In other words, and it certainly goes for myself, I didn't wake up one morning when I was 4 or 5 years old or 14, 15 and think, do you know what, I want to be a university lecturer. And there's a part of
you've
me
been that, an odd child.
Well, I was an odd child, that's the thing that I wanted to do.
But not that old.
No, but it's funny how there comes a point when you realise almost inexorably, you know, you're on a trajectory where you're not really employable. To rephrase that, you've got qualifications in a certain area that kind of means that to do anything else would be a little odd, because why would you invest all that time and family support financially to get through the rigours of a PhD if you then said, I'm going to do something where I don't need those sort of qualifications?
I always wanted to be a teacher, I knew that, because in fact from time to time I go through pictures of family pictures, and there's one of me and my brother at the junior school, because we went to the same junior school, and there's me at a blackboard with a pointer and him standing next to me. So I think I knew that I wanted to be a teacher. I don't know why, but I think from quite a young age. So that would have been about 9, I suppose. No, maybe 10.
And it's just occurred to me that I remember going
to the same event that you went to, probably around 2010, 2011, when Tony Benn came to talk. And his wife, I think, Caroline, was very much involved in education. And I think she was somebody who was, you were telling me, was quite an inspirational figure.
Yes, I think she was at the Institute of Education for a while. I think she was, I think she wrote a book, a very important book about comprehensive education, secondary education.
Yeah.
But I think that was quite a while ago now.
Yeah, yeah. I think she died probably around 2001.
But I didn't go through the comprehensive education system, because where I was born in Guernsey, we had a selective system, and there still is a selective system, although they're about to change it. Much to the aggravation of quite a lot of people, because they think it works in that particular situation. But anyway, they're going to change it.
So is that similar to the selection system that they have in
11 plus?
Yeah.
Well, it was the 11 plus then. I think now, I don't know, it's not called 11 plus anymore, but it's a similar selection. I think there's also more continuous assessment of children, whereas with the regime I was under, you just took a test when you were 11, and nothing about what went on before. So if you were nervous or not very good, you know, in exams, that was it. You went to your secondary school rather than the grammar school.
Because I remember there was some sort of test when I was 11, but it was more for streaming. So it didn't determine which school I went to, but it determined which set I was in at that school. And I was placed in the middle, but a lot of my contemporaries, a lot of my peers were higher up. And I was made to feel that. It was more like, oh, you know, you're in set four and I'm in set one. And I did make my way back, you know, up to the later years. So I reached my... I won't say peak, but I certainly found my form at about 13, 14. Yeah. So for me, I think lots of reasons. I think actually I had a couple of primary school teachers, one in particular, who was very good at sort of showing us how to play chess and drama, but, you know, maths, you know, and actually doing something called what we would now call a curriculum, you know, if it was being practiced, let's put it this way, I wasn't aware of it. And I remember we did all these tests and were like, I can't answer any of these questions because I've never been taught that. But some people were instinctively good and they thrived, and others, perhaps due to the nature of the teaching, perhaps, you know, didn't have the same sort of spark. So you know, but anyway, obviously it didn't do you too badly by the
way. Well, I enjoyed school. I think I enjoyed school right from my very first school. My very first school was a small Roman Catholic primary school, and then I transferred to an ordinary it was not an ordinary primary school, and then went on to the grammar school afterwards. But actually, my memories of the Roman Catholic school weren't very good, because I remember the nuns being particularly cruel. Mm. So I think I probably was glad to get out of it, because they'd been there for donkey's years. My dad had been taught by some of them, and, you know, he remembers being wrapped over the knuckles with the edge of the ruler, not the flat end of the ruler. So I think, you know, I didn't like that sort of regime, really. Although I never had any sort of corporal punishment against me, but corporal punishment was rife.
But when I was in junior school, and a lot of those things happened to me, or to the class, it was more the sort of thing that if somebody, in some cases, it was actually because they didn't remember a line.
I know. Or,
you know,
I know.
And outrageous, you know, pedagogically. Can you imagine if we said to a student now, well, you know, you did a very poor essay, so
you're going
to
clout you around the ear.
Absolutely.
that would go down well.
But back then, and gym as well, particularly, you know, if you weren't performing very well, there was a sense in which you were sort of, let's put it this way, physically spurred on to do better. And in some cases, it was a clear, you know, you were underperforming, and you were made to literally feel that. And that, and in my case, I'm going back to the late 70s, early 80s. But the thing that struck me is that, especially as someone now who works in education, it seems that back then we went to school almost to be disciplined. I don't just mean disciplined as in punished, but there was a sense in which provided you behaved well and you were courteous and you followed the rules, you would be okay. And I think that's why when we had tests, we had exams at that early age, you know, at the age of 11, it never occurred to me that really it was all about getting grades and going on to a really good job, because at that age we just knew that, as you know, the most important thing, the thing that you get a gold star for really, was that you were a good citizen. And I look back on that model now and think, I think I was really held back by that, because when I was given the chance to thrive in later years, and certainly at university, you know, I never looked back. So extraordinary. But so tell me a bit more about Guernsey, because it sounds as though you, what did you spend your whole childhood
on
the island?
So, but it wasn't an easy childhood in some ways, because although Guernsey sounds like an idyllic place, we're talking about 7 years. I mean, I was born 7 years after the war, so money was tight then, actually, and my parents were really working class. I mean, my father was a manual worker. He worked in greenhouses as the tomato industry was thriving in the 1950s. And it was sort of job, if you had no skills, then you went into working in greenhouses. So he worked in greenhouses, and my mother was a domestic. She worked, she did people's housework. And there was no child minding. My mum took me to work with her, and I played in the, I can remember one particular place, there was an orchard, and I played in the orchard while she worked inside. So, and money was always tight. I didn't realise it at the time, but I realise it now. There were lots of rows between my parents, and I think a lot of them were about money. My father had to take part-time jobs to afford to be able to buy things. So, but I wasn't unhappy, because I didn't realise that no children were kind of brandishing things in front of me saying, oh, you know, because now it's all about labels. It wasn't about labels then, of course. So, and not that many people had television. You know, when you heard that somebody had television, you went, ooh, but you didn't crave after television because you didn't really know what it was. So I don't think I had, I think we had a first television early 60s. But I do remember seeing the very first episode of Doctor Who.
Right.
With William Hartnell.
And suddenly the listenership, so this is going to shoot up now. So you remember on the Saturday evening, was it Saturday or Friday
evening?
It was.
It was between the sports results, I think, and the later night thing. It was a Saturday, yeah.
Am I right in thinking
about
that
Boss 5, something
was
like
the first episode of Doctor Who postponed because of JFK's assassination?
Yeah, he died the day before, I think.
So it was shown the week later, is that right?
I think they showed it twice. So, but I don't, I mean, I can remember JFK, the sort of incident, as you remember things like Diana and so on. But it doesn't sort of, I don't remember what I was doing when JFK was assassinated, but I do remember what I was doing when I heard that Diana had been killed, for example. But yeah, but the first Doctor Who, I mean, I'm sure it was awful compared to what we see now. I mean, I'm sure it was grey, and I've seen sort of, I don't think the BBC kept all the episodes.
Well, one of my previous interviewees, Paul March Russell, certainly grew up
watching
a lot of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I don't think he saw the first episode, though.
No. Well, actually,
he may have seen it subsequently, yeah. But I thought...
No, they didn't is the answer, no.
There was no one to compare with William Hartnell as Doctor Who. He had that certain... I don't know what it was about him, but he was the Doctor, and no one has really approached that since. In fact, I think in some cases the Master has been better than the Doctor. But I think Paul talked about that as well.
Yes, he did, Anthony Ainley, yeah, who really spooked me when I was young. But no, William Hartnell, because he was in, I think, the very first Carry On film as well, which I saw, obviously, many years later. Was it the Army one, Carry On Sergeant?
Oh, yes, I remember.
And
that.
Because I only could associate him with Doctor Who, it was very odd seeing him in a different role, which showed that he must have been really good at it, because I couldn't imagine him, you know, and of course the role of the Doctor has changed significantly since then.
I don't think he probably didn't know what he was doing, but it was kind of, because of that, it was sort of, he was feeling his way and it was kind of enigmatic, and I think that's what appealed really. And it was something completely new, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, because when I went to university, I remember there was a Doctor Who society, and I joined it thinking, yeah, I used to enjoy watching Doctor Who. What I realised is that all the people who went there, who were members, were really sci-fi fanatics, and also more than that, they loved the whole, the mathematics of it, almost the sort of the worldview of Doctor Who, which I never got. I saw it as an experiential thing about, yeah, all the sort of these great battles. I've never been into Star Wars, but I used to get Doctor Who. But that was the Doctor Who I grew up with the sort of Tom Baker, Colin Baker, Peter Davison. Yeah. But later, I don't watch it anymore. And it seems now it's lost some of that original. I don't know what it was about the original one in the 70s, 80s, but it felt, maybe it was because of my age. And maybe because, looking back, it was a bit ropey. You could see the sets moving. But but at the time, particularly with The Master, it did really hit a nerve. And it felt like this was something quite unusual and different, because it was sort of like, he looks human, but he's got, and I do a lot of work in Christology, ideas about the person of Christ, but there's lots of that sense there about how he looks on the outside. He can change his form, he almost feels a bit divine. He's able to sort of travel to different sort of and interact with different generations of people in different ways. So I think that Doctor Who indirectly kickstarted an interest in theology. That's what I'm sort of getting at, and for me it's completely bound up with that whole sort of growing up thing, and I haven't, interestingly, been able to watch the latest incarnations of Doctor Who, because for me it's completely bound up with my childhood. I'd watch those original episodes again, but I'm not sure I want to start from scratch.
That's interesting, because I don't watch it anymore either, and I felt that it's lost its appeal because it's become too high-tech in a way, which is ridiculous, I know. Yeah. I mean, it can't compete with the Hollywood-style sci-fi, but I think it's lost its... That's you're right, actually. Mm. We never knew how old the Doctor was, for example.
No.
I mean, and the fact that he could be reincarnated. Supposedly, was it only 9 times? But I think that's been exceeded.
Oh,
now.
I think so now, yeah.
But they probably don't want us to think about that, really. But,
no.
But there are always people who know about tiny points. That are like,
but those were the people... When I went to the society, it wasn't just about the episodes. They were actually looking at the time... It was the time travel. It was the physics, the laws of... It was Einstein.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, I'm out of my depth here. And it was very interesting, because my sense of... It's the equivalent of, I suppose, a piece of music that's very powerful. Maybe you associate it with a particular family member.
Oh, that and, music?
Yeah.
Whoever... Well, they did that in the Radiophonic Workshop, didn't they, the first one? And it was Verity Lambert who's the first producer, I think. It's the first woman producer of in the BBC.
Did she do Blue Peter as well? But certainly,
yes, she did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I know. But that music, you can't... And I think the original one, I mean, there was someone who explained how it was done once. It wasn't done, with a lot of scientific equipment. It was actually done, I think, quite simply, but the effect was tremendous.
But they all were the Blue Peter thing. Even I remember growing up, the 6 o'clock news, there was a sense almost you wanted to stand on ceremony. It was so authoritative.
Yeah.
And that said something perhaps about the BBC at the time. But yeah, Doctor Who was certainly part of that era.
Did you ever watch Magpie?
Oh, that was that on ITV?
Yeah.
Maybe not. Not that I didn't watch ITV, but no, I...
You didn't like the...
No, let me say, what was Magpie? Because I know there was the whole sort of... Saturday
similar
morning,
to
Tis
Blue
Wars.
Peter.
Yeah.
But I think there were kind of panels on it.
Did it have Jenny Hanley on
it?
Was the sister of Jeremy Hanley, the Tory politician, and the daughter of Dinah... Oh, it's going to come to me. She was in the film about the Brighton to London...
Oh, right.
Right, car race. Yeah.
I don't
Dinah
know.
Sheridan, I think, yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
So Magpie, what was that about?
I think it was some kind... Well, it was a children's programme, but you'll have to Google it, because my memory isn't brilliant of it. But I think it was some kind of programme where they had sort of... It seemed to me a bit like the cross between Blue Peter and Countryfile for children. Do you watch Countryfile?
No. Do you know? I don't, well, I go to the cinema because you're a friend of mine on Facebook, and you probably sort of
I see you going to different.
I do go,
films.
But I don't watch TV, so that's why.
Right.
Yeah. So
I
don't
watch TV a lot, but I find the problem with having 300 plus channels is that you spend all your time flicking through them, and not actually much time watching programs.
And for me, when I'm at the cinema and I'm sitting And also if there are people around you, because I've just started doing mindfulness training, and I was very conscious the other evening that even popcorn was going to be heard by people. I was conscious that people might be thinking, God, he's crunching a lot. So when I'm there, but it's the patience of sitting there and having to be disciplined.
Yeah,
is a wonderful experience in a way.
You can't get your phone out.
No, and for a few hours, it's like when you're lecturing and you know that you can't check your email. It's a moment when you sort of feel, make the most of it. So it's a great balance, being at work by day, cinema by night. But for me, if I was at home watching the TV, I'd know I feel I was wasting my life. I would just be going, oh, watch this for a few minutes, doesn't interest me, go on to something else.
But so I think
it's like I'm looking for depth. It's funny, but I find depth in very silly films sometimes. It's not a quality thing, but it's almost as though it's the sustained,
like the Carry On films.
Well, even those. Well, I've had that conversation with one of my Well, you hit some good one-liners.
That I guess good one-liners. Yeah. Absolutely.
Infamy. Infamy.
Back to Guernsey then. So I think I did have a truly... I mean, I lived in the equivalent of a Guernsey council house. So, and I lived in... I think we moved three times. I lived in a house and then in a flat and then in a house again. And, I mean, they were pretty basic things. I mean... You know, the two of the houses had loos that were outside. I mean, not actually in the garden, but outside the back door. So, you know, it's part of the kind of... So we're not talking about luxury, even though it was Guernsey. Because I think people think... When you say to someone that you were born in Guernsey, they immediately think, you know, wealth.
I have to say that when you said Guernsey... I was thinking, oh, you must come from, you know, a wealthy background. And because I know certainly with Jersey, to live there now, there has to be some sort of...
Well, it's the same with Guernsey. You have
to remember, it is the same with Guernsey.
But my background is more kind of, you know, Guernsey potato, literary pie thing.
I've seen that.
Rather than sort of 21st century Guernsey. I'm talking about something that was... As I said before, it was just after the war that I was born, in a way. I mean, 7 years is not a long time. And there was still... I mean, well, there are still there, actually, lots of these fascist bunkers that were built by the Germans. And they remain there as a kind of a statement. So there were lots of mines still on the beaches. Occasionally now, the mines turn up and they have to call out the services and dismantle them and so on, because they're quite dangerous even now, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that kind of thing, really. It wasn't the sort of, you know, infinity pools. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? If you fly over Guernsey, you look down, you can see all the swimming pools in the back gardens, and you think, well, that's happened in the last 30 or 40 years. So, I went to an outside swimming pool as a kid. You know, that was good, actually, because we had swimming pools that were constantly renewed by the tide, because the tidal flow is very great. I'm talking about 32 feet between high tide and low tide.
What do you remember doing as a child? What are your earliest memories?
Do you know, some of my earliest memories are actually sitting in the road, playing with sticks in the tar, and the tar bubbling up, and being able to sit there for ages without a car coming along, which you couldn't do now. Okay. I mean, you couldn't. And I remember my mother sending me up the road, because there was a grocery shop up the road, and she used to say, if a car comes, you have to stand up against the wall till the car's gone by, for safety's sake. And I can remember doing that. And sometimes I didn't have to do it at all. And that, well, I'm talking about a 5-10 minute walk to the shop, and 5-10 minute walk back. How things have changed. I wouldn't be able to walk that distance now, and that road, I know that road now, there are cars going up and down there all the time. Yeah.
And because I've got such young children, I've been in situations where they just want to run off into a road or start playing in a car park. You know, you take one, change one's, you know, nappy in the toilet, and one of them sort of disappears. And, you know, so I can imagine that... Yeah, it's all changed a lot. But, I mean, that sounds incredible, though, actually, that you could... It almost feels like, you know, those films, sometimes where you've got sort of like... often for like Stephen King novellas, but, you know, the sort of sense of the children all sort of going as a group, learning about themselves, but sort of just sitting in a natural environment, or maybe fishing, or sitting in the road playing, you know, ball games or something, but actually just sort of finding out about themselves in a way that doesn't happen in the same way now. I mean, there's so many virtual connections.
Well, I remember, I mean, there were so few cars that and we didn't have many cars in our family. I mean, my parents certainly didn't have a car. In fact, we never had a car. My father was on a push bike and then a motorbike, and my mum had a push bike, and that was it. But I can remember when I was a child tripping over in the back garden. It was a prop that my mum used for the line, tripping over it, and my thumb actually disappeared into my hand. I think that can happen with small children because their bones are so sort of malleable. And I can remember having, we didn't have a telephone, so I can remember, I think my dad walking down to my uncle, who lived about 10 minutes away, who had a car, saying, do you think you could take Michael to a hospital because he's had an accident with his thumb? And I can actually, I can remember pain because I can remember them pulling the thumb without anaesthetic out of the kind of my hand to straighten it up because it had just kind of almost disappeared into my hand. Mm. And I can remember the pain of that still.
Do you know, I've always had this fear of wasps, and I've never been into needles, and I wonder whether I was stung when I was young. It's not obviously, well, it might be as traumatic as what you said, but, you know, in the scheme of things, getting bitten is sort of, you know, something that happens all the time. But I had to be taken to hospital in order to have some splinters removed once, or a sting, because I just couldn't. You know, I was just screaming in agony or fear when that was being undertaken by my, by my mother. I was just struck as you, by the sound of it, then you were born in the year of, well, obviously when the Queen acceded to the throne. Yeah. Also, you know where I'm going with this, the year of the charts, because obviously one of my obsessions is this whole sort
of...
They started in November 1952.
Oh, right, I was born the following month.
Ah, oh, so here in my heart, Al Martino was number one when you... Oh, do you know, this is...
I don't remember.
it's one of my odd quirks that I always want to sort of think, well, what was number one? It's always, like, I've never been into horoscopes, but you know that sort of sense of trying to define somebody or sort of think, you know, this was the song that was what everybody was listening to or buying when you were born. So I do remember
the radio being on a lot, though, with music, and I remember strange things like a song called Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny
Yellow Polka Dot Bikini.
But I don't know when that was from. Was that the 60s, that one?
I think that was 1960, but it could have been very late 50s.
But yeah. I think there were... I mean, you've got a book up there, Vera Lynn. I'm sure we heard Vera Lynn on the radio. And I can remember listening with Mother as well, with Daphne Oxenford. That was on before Woman's Hour at 1:45. And I can remember as a child listening to that. And, you know, I can still remember the music, because I'm musical. The music was that was from the Dolly Suite by Fauré, and I can still remember that. And apparently the woman who introduced the programme, it wasn't Daphne Oxenford, but I think somebody else at that stage, had to rush over from the microphone to the piano to actually play the piece live. Mm. She had to play the piece live each time it was broadcast.
Yeah. What about Uncle Mac and Children's Hour?
I don't remember that so much. Yeah. I don't know why. I think I know why, because Saturday morning was Saturday morning cinema. And we used to go to the cinema. It's children's cinema time. I think the 50s and the 60s were big for children's cinema. We used to go to the Odeon the Saturday morning. It was a kind of boys and girls cinema club. It was riotous, actually, to be quite honest with you, because there were lots of kids. I mean, okay, you know, they weren't that badly behaved, I suppose, but they were quite badly behaved, jumping around. There was lots of noise.
Can you remember what you saw? Which films on those Saturday mornings?
Well, it was a kind of compilation of stuff that we saw. So we saw, they left you on a cliffhanger because each week, because we saw kind of episodes of things, like Zorro was one of them, I remember. I don't know if it's called The Sword of Zorro or Zorro.
The Mark or The Mask or something like that.
Yes, I think it might have been The Mask of Zorro, and then what else did we see? Flash Gordon, I think. And what they did was, there was a kind of bit where you were wondering what was going to happen, and then it stopped, which was to encourage you going back, to go back the following week. And they were, so it was a, I think it's probably to keep the interest of children. I don't think children would have sat through a long film, so I think it was, there was kind of, I don't know what the pattern was, but I think there was a kind of pattern to what you watched. There's cartoons, of course.
Because I've never quite understood the need sometimes for closure in films, you know, the happy ending syndrome. Because when you watch a soap opera, then the whole point is that you're going to watch the next episode because it's finished with the cliffhanger. But it used to happen at cinemas too. So what you were saying you used to witness on a Saturday morning, there was the incentive to come back the next week and it would all, you know, continue again. And yet these days, sometimes what for me is frustrating about film is that there's a certain closure sometimes which doesn't fit with where the film has been taking up to that point. That sometimes ending on a note of ambiguity is great because you can sort of say, okay, why isn't the world, you know, like that, you know? And sometimes we don't find closure in our days. I don't leave work of an evening and think, oh, I've completed all my tasks. So, you know, why are we looking for closure sometimes in entertainment? But no, I that's not quite my era. Or maybe it was, and I just didn't go to the cinema because I'm a bit of a late convert. It was only at university that I started going to see films. And actually, one of the earliest films that I saw, which is similar to what you've just been outlining, the one with Timothy Dalton in it, Rocketeer.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
Yeah, that came out in 91, but very much of that sort of vintage. With the whole sort of, you know, it's obviously a throwback to Saturday morning cinema, but with the Nazi villains and the, you know, sort of using the rocket to try and, you know, save the world.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And there was Lone Ranger as well, watch that. And Batman, early Batman. And that was another one that they could leave on a cliffhanger. So, you know, in the middle of something and then, of course, there was the break. How those usherettes managed with all those kids, you know, clambering around, I don't know, it's been a bit of a nightmare.
Well, I went to the BFI to see, for the first time, The Sound of Music just a month ago, and they had the interval, and there were a few generations of people. I went on my own, but there was a family behind me with their young daughter, and I got the sense that this was a film that the parents grew up on, and then in a way they were happy for their, you know, to see if their daughter was going to be inspired as they were. And first of all, I thought, oh, you know, there's no way I've got a six-year-old, is going to sit through a film that's, you know, getting on for 3 hours, but everybody did. There was an interval.
Did they?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You think now they would be less likely to because of there's so many things to distract them. When you were saying before about going to the cinema and not being able to switch your phone on, there are so many distractions now that don't enable you to concentrate very well. Everybody seems hooked on social media. And I think people enjoy it, but you're a slave. You can easily become a slave to it. I mean, I see people who are constantly writing on Facebook, and I think, okay, in one way you can look at it as a current diary, if you like. It's a way of keeping a diary, and it'll probably be there forever. But you wonder who's going to publish the diaries of the future, because they'll be electronic diaries, I suppose. They won't be written diaries. You keep a written diary.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I write a diary which I know I can't disseminate, in the sense that, well, well, for
republishing to go into in the future.
posthumously, maybe, or maybe it'll be the publishing that will cause the death of me. But no, I write up to 2,000 words a day, but I've been doing this, you know, incrementally for decades.
Yeah.
Now, I'm only recently, you know, an active user of social media. And in a way, it's almost like saying to people, you're not going to see the real diary. And the real diary, I think, has more substance, because what you've got on social media, it's going to be a little bit flimsy, and it's often just you put things down that are going to hopefully get people's attention, or you put little images like mindfulness. Recently, I put a picture of me here in my office with a mat on the floor. Yeah,
I saw that,
and I did that. But also, I thought, well, that's the whole thing. Is that, you know, I'm sort of like, years ago, I thought I would never do social media. I thought that, you know, it's for other people. And now I've harnessed it, and I sort of feel my own voice, my own character is coming through. Because the diaries, which I think will probably give people, you know, were they ever to be published in the future, a real insight into who I am. But, you know, that's great in 20, 30, 40, whatever years' time. But Facebook is very much of the now.
Yes, it is.
The diaries for me, is a lot of it is going backwards. Obviously, a lot of the things I do in my job is forward-thinking, you know, what I'm going to be doing in 6 months' time, etc. But Facebook probably is, of all the things I do, and maybe that's why I'm interested in mindfulness at the moment, is very much of the present moment.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, I'm a kind of lurker, really, in most of these things. I don't tweet either. I think once you've got a kind of range of these things, it just takes up so much time. Some people would say no, it wouldn't take any more time than, you know, across a day, than writing a diary entry at the end of the evening. I don't know, really, but to me it seems like a kind of distraction. And I'm easily distracted, so, you know, I prefer not to get too heavily involved.
But what inspired you then, growing up in Guernsey, to end up? I mean, you know, you
given the answer. What's my journey?
Is what the journey from Guernsey? Don't say, you know, across the about 15 miles.
It's longer than
Is it longer than that?
It's about 90 to Weymouth.
90 miles?
Yeah.
Really? Of course, I suppose I'm thinking of the Isle of Wight, of course, which is
but
about
15.
But you
see, Guernsey's always looked to England as its mainland.
But you're closer to France, aren't
you? Yeah, about 20 miles or
so. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of, yeah.
You can see France on a clear day. You can't see the UK ever. It's strange how that's happened. That's a historical thing, really. Now, what happened was that, well, when I came to deciding what I was going to do next after school, I mean, I went to a grammar school that wasn't particularly dynamic, to be quite honest with you. It's very small. I mean, there aren't many secondary schools that got 320 students. It's a two-form entry, normally about 30 students in each form, perhaps fewer, actually. One year, there was a three-form entry, and it sort of caused mayhem, but it was a two-form entry. Everything was really rather limited. We didn't have a great sort of academic background, in a way. We were just fairly bright kids that got through this thing called 11 plus, and then we just basically followed an academic pathway. So I knew that I wanted to be a teacher, so I decided that I would go to a college of education, which was the thing you did. So that's what I did. So I moved from Guernsey, which is quite a big thing, really, but I went to Devon. And in fact, the college of education I went to, which was in Exmouth, was associated with the University of Exeter, so the degrees were validated by the university. I believe earlier on, I think in the 1950s and 60s, it's quite an old college of education, that it was an adjunct of Exeter University, but it became a Devon County Council college, and I went there. And I did two subjects. Well, I did three, really. I did music in English and education. And I continued with music in English for 2 years, and then I had to decide in my final year to either do music or English, and I decided to do English. And then I did English for my degree, because it was a 3+1. You did Cert Ed, and then if you did well at the Cert Ed, and I was lucky I got distinction, so I easily went on to do the B.Ed, which was a new degree in those days, actually. So I did a B.Ed and then went back to my old school as a teacher, not to be advised.
Yeah, a lot of my students do that. Sometimes they go back. It's a cycle, you know. They're inspired by their teachers. They go to university, get the qualifications, do a PGCE, and then go back and teach in their same school. I've got a few friends like that.
Yeah, well, I didn't enjoy it, to be quite honest. So I did 5 years and decided I'd had enough. Because the head teacher, who was quite authoritarian, decided that I was still the Michael Hughes that had left when he was 18, and really treated me like I was an 18-year-old, even though I was in my 20s, mid-20s. He just treated me like a pupil. So I'd had enough of that, really. He didn't take me seriously. So I decided, I went on a big adventure and decided to go to Manchester. Just outside of Manchester, I taught in a grammar school there. And I hated it. I hated Manchester. I hated the school. But I think I did that on purpose, really. Because I think I wanted a change of direction. And that's what I got from moving, both geographically and in terms of my work. Because I went from a small grammar school, kind of semi-rural type of environment, like a sort of village type environment, being in Guernsey, to a grammar school on the outskirts of Manchester, which was in a pretty rough area. And even though the kids were bright, they were rough. So I think that sort of made me decide I wanted to do something else. So I resigned from that. And I went back home for a short time, did some work, and then started my new career as an English language teacher. I actually started a bit earlier than taking any qualifications, because I started, they were always desperate for people in the summer, because there were English language courses held in Guernsey, a nice place to go, and I taught on those. They were tended to be German students, and I taught on those for, I think, 2 years running, became director of studies without any qualification, just a degree. And then I thought, there's more to this than meets the eye. You can't just teach English with you know, you can't just do language teaching with being a native speaker and just kind of knowing about something about the language. So I went on one of those one-month training courses, which I did in International House in Hastings, interestingly enough. But before that, I worked in Selfridges for a while, and that was an interesting experience. See, I feel that sometimes people come into university teaching, into academic life, without any kind of other kind of background, apart from maybe the odd summer job or something as a student. And I think I've had a kind of perhaps a more interesting background than some people might have found. I think it makes you better for it, actually.
And I think that the students of today, because so many of them do hold down jobs, part-time jobs, and indeed in many cases they live at home and work and commute to campus, whereas I, at university, literally, you know, lived on the campus and stayed on the campus, really. You know, yeah, I had no reason to ever get off. Yeah.
And I was away across the sea, so it wasn't easy to go home. Did you go home very much?
Well, I lived in Cardiff, and I was at university in Lampeter, so it was only about an hour and 40 minutes away. But a world away, in other ways.
Well,
so I made the opposite journey to you. I went from the city, albeit admittedly in the suburbs, to a very rural area, and it was unbelievable, really. It was because of the people. Take the people away, it's a small town, a lovely town, but it was the people who came from all parts of the world, literally, especially with the introduction in later years of the Centre for Islamic Studies, and in which case we had, you know, I mean, what I would learn, you know, you'd be walking in the streets of this small Welsh, you know, market town, and you'd have conversations with people from, you know, anywhere and everywhere, and I thought you wouldn't even get that, you know, on the streets of Manchester to the same degree, you know, it was all coalescing in the same environment.
Well, Manchester wasn't very nice in the early 80s, I can tell you. It was before inner city regeneration. It was a bit of a dump, to be quite honest with you, and I really hated it. I just hated the whole thing, really. So I was glad to get away. So English language teacher was my passport to working abroad, which is what I did before I came to the University of Kent, which is how I got the job here anyway. If I hadn't, it was all sort of serendipitous. If I hadn't, I think everybody's life is a bit like that, really. If I hadn't done this, this wouldn't have happened. And if I hadn't done that, that wouldn't have happened. And it so happened that I'd spent quite a lot of time working abroad. I was quite well qualified and experienced in English language teaching, and that's why I was asked to come and fill in here. It was just a sort of temporary thing.
Which countries did you teach in?
Oh, quite a lot, because I also became an overseas examiner for an exam board, so I not only taught but also visited a lot of places I wouldn't have gone to otherwise. So it was really eye-opening and wonderful. I'd never have gone to Japan or Uruguay or Argentina or Sri Lanka if I hadn't had this sort of background. But teaching-wise, I taught mostly in Europe. I taught in Austria for a short time, and then I went to Spain. That was for 2 years. And then I went to Germany. And then I did some short contracts in Italy and in Sweden. And for somebody who'd come from a small island and basically gone, you know, into higher education and then back into a school, it was a complete eye-opener. I'm really glad I did it, because I wouldn't have had a clue, apart from the odd holiday here and there.
Yeah. And did you feel that it had an influence on you? Did you feel, when you were in teaching in these different countries, were you sort of... did you find it was a completely eye-opening experience?
Oh, yeah. It made me empathise with people, because there I was struggling with language frequently. So those students that I've taught later on who have, you know, a problem with learning a language, I know exactly what they're going through, because I started off in most countries, I had a little bit of German, but I started off in most countries with zero and had to try and battle my way through. I mean, in some countries it was easier than others. I mean, Sweden, for example, you've got no problem. I can remember a very funny incident when I I was learning Swedish because I felt any country I've been to, I feel I should try and learn at least a bit of the language, even if I was there for a short time. And I remember going into a supermarket and the supermarket checkout girl, who was probably somebody, it was a sort of part-time job for them or something, you know, but, I started talking to her in Swedish. She said, "Can't we just speak in English? It's easier." And I'm sure that happens to people, that they want to try and speak in the language that they're learning, but people say, "Well, your level is a bit low, so should we just speak in English instead?" I can remember being really embarrassed and not being able to get a lot of practice. In places like Scandinavia, it's difficult to get the practice because everybody speaks English so well.
I had the opposite problem when I was in Switzerland, because I have a very poor sort of, you know, language competence, and I was trying to speak in English, and most people, or many people, did, but there were a few for whom either, you know, I think I was in the Italian side of the southern part of Switzerland, and yeah, so that was an eye opener as well. But yeah, the, you know, I sort of went in thinking, well, actually, I can only speak English, and although I've never been a linguist, there is a part of me that sort of feels, well, there is more to the world. Even I'm Welsh myself. I can speak a little bit of Welsh, but yeah, I should have taken it more. And I think it may have made me see the world through a very different lens, which I don't think I've had. In a way, the world has come to me, certainly in the job here at Kent. Yeah. I have students who come to me, and I learn a lot about other people's lives. But through these interviews, I suppose the same. But I've had the opportunity later this summer to go to Bosnia. And I'm thinking, goodness me, that's so outside my comfort zone, but maybe I should do it. That's the sort of thing I mean. And some people would say, yeah, why don't you go? It's because, well, actually, I didn't get a passport until I was, oh, goodness me, late 20s. I went to Switzerland. That was my first trip abroad.
Well, I think it makes me able to empathise rather than sympathise with students who struggle. But the as you say, the language is not the only thing, because you learn so much about the way people live just by observing and by doing your everyday, carrying out your everyday life of shopping and, you know, spare time activities and so on. You learn what other people do. For example, when I was in Spain, you couldn't get anything. If you wanted to go out to eat, you couldn't get anything much before about 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening. And actually, that's affected me ever since, because I can't eat early. I can't eat at 5. I mean, a lot of people go home directly from work and eat. I can't. I have to unwind and then kind of, you know, I get hungry at about 8 or 9 o'clock. And that, I don't know why, but that's just stuck with me.
No, if I had something to eat at 5 o'clock, I'd have to have another meal again before bed.
You'd have to have supper.
I normally have something at the cinema, and then I absolutely, when I come in, I'll have it may just be a ready meal, but something, you know, easily, even well after midnight sometimes, I've got the stove on.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I tend to eat a bit too late, which is not supposed to be good for you, but I don't get indigestion. Yeah. I mean, some people say, don't you get indigestion going to bed, you know, just having eaten? I said, no. But I suppose it's what you get used to, really.
But a friend of mine used to go to bed with Lucozade, so I thought, I don't know, but that's, I'll interview him one day, because there's a whole narrative there, I'm sure. What about sort of more widely? I mean, one of the questions I've been asking other interviewers are sort of questions, not necessarily at university, but sort of questions around, you know, sports or politics or religion or music or film. Was there anything from your studies that had nothing to do with what you were studying that really made you think, wow, you know, this is something which is a great counterpart to the studying? And I had that with radio, for example.
Yeah, I like radio, but then I've always got radio on. But I think for me, it's classical music. Because even though I mean, I did study it, I think I've got I'm quite narrow and quite broad in some ways. I mean, if you asked me what was in the charts at the moment, I couldn't tell you.
Oh, I couldn't either. I stopped around 1990. I have a niche interest.
You like ABBA, do you?
Yeah, absolutely fine.
Because there's sort of lots of, you know, when you talk about, if you're talking about nostalgia, there's a kind of nostalgia with the music, isn't there? That you hear, music's a very nostalgia sort of invoking thing, isn't it? Because you hear music and you kind of know what you were doing at that particular time, and possibly the way you were dressed as well. If you think about the way people dressed in the 70s and 80s and the sort of disco, whole disco thing, the whole disco movement. I mean, I lived through that sort of disco time, and it's difficult to realise now, but I think, you know, when you come across sort of 18 to 21 year olds, as the majority of the students are here, and you think they probably wouldn't realise that when I was their age, I was sort of tripping across the dance floor, literally. They probably don't. They probably wouldn't imagine that. Yeah, they probably wouldn't imagine that, would they? They probably don't think about that. Probably don't. In fact, they probably don't notice you anyway. But you know, there was someone in one of my classes, for example, who'd fallen over in the venue, and I thought, I wonder if you realise that, you know, some years ago, a lot of years ago, that I would have probably done the same thing, because she was quite embarrassed by it, because she had a big bump. And I thought, I wonder if you realise that I could have done exactly the same thing. And I said, oh, that's a real shame, thinking, what was she doing to do that? Apparently somebody had held her up by her legs and she'd fallen onto the ground. I think,
No, we had a student 1 year who was wheelchair bound because of whatever had gone on at the... one thing I found actually some years ago, and which probably put me off going on Facebook for a few years, was that we got a religious studies Facebook page, and there was a time when the students were keen for the staff to be involved. But what I used to find is that the students were putting up pictures of themselves at the venue, with, you know, the campus, you know, dancing, you know, place, and there was part of me that thought, well, actually, I don't think I should or really want to be looking at this, because if I'm teaching students and maybe a student's, you know, missed a few classes, I don't really want to be able to think, yeah, but you were dancing last night and there, you know, you were, you know, having a few drinks. No, I think that there's a line there. Although these days, of course, I suppose my students are probably looking at me thinking, what's he doing with
a
yoga mat in his office?
I've had a few requests from students to for them to join my Facebook page, and I've actually not responded, because I think that there's a... Would you want your students looking in your diary?
No.
I don't do that. I mean, I'll do it when they graduate.
Oh, that's what I mean. I've got quite a few former students.
I wouldn't do it, I think, while they're still students. Because, you know, there may be... You don't know, but there may be just something up there and you think, no, I don't think they should see that, really. I mean, do they want to see me in my jam jams? Do you know what I mean? I'm not... That doesn't happen. But you know what I mean, though? I just think they're... There is a dividing line, really. Mm.
But also I think it's for the student as well, that they need to be able to know that if they need a reference or they need help with their coursework, that they're going to an authority figure. And and although, of course, we are human beings as well, they don't need to know all that we get up to. And I'm conscious, I sometimes put things up publicly on Facebook, but there's a part that if I'm reviewing a film, I want people to be able to read it. And I'm happy for my students to read it if need be. But I am conscious sometimes that there's a bit of line crossing potentially going on.
Well, I mean, your interests are bound to come out, aren't they, through Facebook. And sometimes I log into, because I'm interested in church music and I belong to quite a number of choirs, and we go around the country singing in various cathedrals and priories and abbeys. And I think what my students think of this, see me sort of logging on to Bolton Priory or Wells Cathedral or York Minster, they think I'm a right jerk. So I'd rather they didn't see that.
No, but at the same time, they'll think, oh, that's, you know, that's very serious. And they'll that is very serious.
Although we do have lots of laughs.
Whereas if they sort of see me going to see some very sort of peculiar, you know, films sometimes, or indeed...
I can't imagine what you mean.
No, or some of the music tastes that I have, they might think that's a bit low culture. Or they might sometimes just think Chris is sort of a human being like us. But actually, that said, it doesn't come up, even with the students or former students I'm on Facebook with. We never really talk about it, you know, in the sense that when you meet people, you have the same dynamics, you know, that we're there. It's just that Facebook is a sort of... it's a good way of showing off one's, I guess, really alter ego. It's really the sort of thing you can sort of just say, this is me. Not so much vulnerable, but it's a way of saying sometimes, well, you know, I have other interests and I need to find an outlet for them, which are not going to come through my teaching, because obviously the teaching really is not supposed to be an opportunity for you to talk about your, you know, personal life story. But there is a part of me, and these interviews are one way of doing that, the diary certainly, where I sort of feel, well, we all have a story to tell, but we can't always disseminate that story. And so something like Facebook is a good way of just giving people a glimpse, a small portal into our wider, shall we say, hinterland.
Yeah.
No, that's great. And obviously the radio interest, I would love to pick up on that. But for me, absolutely, I can chart, literally and figuratively, all sorts of events from the last 30 even 40 years, based on what was in the news, but which I heard on the radio, the songs from the time, often the gaps between the records, as they often were vinyl in those days.
Yeah.
And it was those, and often the trivial conversations, but they're the ones that stay with you because they're real, rather than the rehearsed ones. I mean, even for these interviews, I could easily have sort of done them so formally that we all have a bit of a script to work from. But who'd want to listen to that?
Are you a Steve Wright person? Well, I'm Steve Wright.
Yeah, but the fact is, that's Zoo Radio. Right. And I like the intimacy. I grew up with a lot of presenters. Radio 1 was like that in the 80s, certainly, with, you know, one-to-one, Mike Reed on The Breakfast Show. Yeah. Radio 2 now is very Zoo. I listen to Radio 2, but particularly listen to people like Sarah Kennedy or Chris Stewart, Ed Stewart as well, who...
Stewart, and he goes back a long way.
Yeah, I mean, well, because I wrote on
him... Didn't he do Children's Favourites or something like
he
that?
He did Junior Choice. Which, that's it. And I've written on that in my Christmas book, and also actually, what was for me absolutely gut-wrenching was that I thought, because I wrote about Junior Choice in the book I wrote on Christmas a couple of years ago, I thought, well, should I tell Ed Stewart? You know, or he might just think, who's this nutter? You know, because I'm sure he's used to, you know, stalkers and, you know, but listeners who sometimes are crossing the line. We're talking about, you know, whether our students should know what we get up to in our spare time. But if you're on the radio with millions of listeners, then you know, you must attract lots of unwanted, you know, attention. So I thought, you know, I might just get rejection, as in no response at all. I suppose there was a part of me that thought he might say, oh, you know, come, maybe next Christmas, come and watch Junior Choice being recorded. Or he might just say, oh, thanks very much. You know, it's great to know that what we're doing is, you know, worthy of some sort of academic study. Anyway, I got the proofs from the publisher in January, 9th of January 2016, and I thought, okay, what shall I do about this? Anyway, went to Westwood Cross and with my children and, you know, put the radio on, and it was just before, I think, 7 o'clock in the evening, and they were playing Champion the Wonder Horse, and I thought, hey, why are they playing that? I said, they played that Christmas Day on Junior Choice. I thought, you know, you don't hear that on Radio 2 these days. And something, I thought, something doesn't feel quite right. First story on the news, Ed Stewart has died. And I thought, I don't believe this. And it was one of those sort of like, there was an opportunity, I never took it, and it's too late. And I've had loads of those sort of experiences of sort of moments where having the radio on in the background during particularly important events of my life. And part of me sort of feels there is a thread there that I kind of want to tap into. Actually, Junior Choice was on the radio the morning I was born in 1973, and you know, and I can follow all sorts of narratives there. So there's a part of me that's, you know, in reconnecting with my past, I'm very conscious that it's a radio past that I'm reconnecting with. But have you had similar sort of experiences
with radio? You mean, you know, I now listen almost solidly to Radio 3, which, I mean, I think some people, when I say that to some people, they kind of think he's a nerd. But I listen to Radio 4 sometimes. I tend to listen to Radio 4 when I don't like what's on Radio 3. So if there's something, if there's some ultra-modern music on, or modern, I like jazz, but I don't like very modern jazz, I'll turn over to Radio 4. That normally coincides with Today in Parliament, which is eye-opening. But I suppose the thread with the radio that goes through with me is the children's programmes, I think, which I remember. And then there's a kind of gap, really. And then my interest in, I suppose, Radio 4, because I do like Radio 4, and then moving almost entirely into listening to Radio 3. I don't think there's anything quite like Radio 3.
No, I used the word in a different context earlier, cultural heritage.
Yeah.
But Radio 3 and Radio 4 certainly have that. And in a way, you dare not change those schedules. Radio 2's had a lot of flack lately for its new drive time show with a male and a female presenter, which feels a bit sort of corporate. But Radio 3 and Radio 4, no, for a lot of people, you know, that must never be touched. It's the equivalent of a National Trust, you know, house. You know, you mustn't knock down the walls.
Yes, I know. But comedy on Radio 4 has been something that I've... Like, I'm sorry, I'll read that again. I don't know if you remember that. That's always been the comedy for me. Dead Ringers now, for example. I love those. I think Radio 4 does comedy better than anyone else. I really enjoy those. And I try to go to live recordings if I possibly can, or live shows, or recordings rather. So I've been to a few comedy ones, but I've actually started, this is another nerdy project, of going around all the cathedrals in the UK, because it's something I can do now I've got more time. And one of the things I try to do is to go to the live broadcasts of Choral Evensong on a Wednesday afternoon. Now, how nerdy is that? But you know, there are a group of people who do the same thing, yeah, as me. And I belong to a Radio 3 forum which discusses Choral Evensong.
But that sounds like an amazing form of community where you've got people like-minded. Oh, yeah, but also it involves travel, because that's, yeah, for me. I mean, I go to the cinema a lot, but that's the crucial thing. It's the journey there, it's the ritual, it's the pilgrimage. Yeah. So no matter how good or bad the film, in a way, there's a certain effort involved, which is not the straightforward case of, I've had a busy day at work, I'll pick up the remote control. No. What you're doing... I know you said that you thought the students might think, oh, what's he up to? I think the opposite. I think that's an incredibly aspirational thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just an interest of yours. You actually make the physical effort, and it sounds like a pilgrimage.
It is, I suppose. I can remember one day going to, it was Ash Wednesday, I think, going to St John's College, Cambridge, to participate in Choral Evensong, which I think was recorded that particular day, and then walking to King's College for more of the same. And I thought to myself, where else could you do this? To go to one city and walk between two colleges that have the most amazing choral tradition within a couple of hours of each other. There is nowhere else you could do that. It was just superb. And King's College Chapel, in the twilight, or even in the dark, with those sort of lights on, and the atmosphere is fantastic. Really is. Mm-hmm. I love cathedrals. I love cathedrals and old chapels and things like that. They're just wonderful. And you think about all those people that have sung in that environment and have worshipped in that environment over hundreds of years, you know, going back. So I suppose that's sort of a kind of nostalgia.
Because I've seen you at Canterbury Cathedral reading out the names of the
graduates. Yes. Yeah. Well, I do that every year. That's sort of, I've been doing that for about 20 years.
So it sounds like that's a real labour of love then.
That shows a thread, doesn't it, really? I seem to be drawn to old buildings and ceremonial. Don't ask me why. Because a lot of these things, like Choral Evensong, they're, you know, Evensong is set in stone. There's no variation to it. It's one of those things that wherever you go in the country, wherever it's you have Choral Evensong, it's the same. And I think, I suppose, that sort of ceremonial with the graduation ceremony, that's the same as well. I think there are people who would probably like to modernise it, but there's resistance to that kind of thing. And there's resistance to modernising something like Evensong as a liturgical event, I suppose.
Mm. I've got one more question for you.
Oh, yeah.
Would you consider yourself, yes, and I've asked this question and I've had the question put back at me, thrown at me, refused to answer. But are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I tend to think that as I've got older, I'm neither. That I tend, although I've talked a lot about the past during the last hour, I think I tend to think more about now, to be quite honest with you. Because I don't know about the future. As you get older, the future becomes increasingly uncertain, and you don't know what turn your life will take next. And I don't really like thinking back too much, to be quite honest with you. I prefer to think about now and a little bit into the future. So that's it, really. So I'm neither backward-looking nor forward-looking, really. I think more about now and the immediate future rather than anything long-term. Yeah.
But it also sounds that you've got so many things going on that you've got a lot to draw on. There's a lot of heritage.
Yeah, that's true,
So you go to these ancient buildings. But at the same time, it looks as though you're always planning the next trip. It sounds as though you're in a good place at the moment.
Yes, I suppose I am, really, because the problem with having a permanent job, which you all like to have and which people don't want to give up, is that it gives you very little room for being able to do what you want and to be able to travel particularly. And I think I caught the travel bug when I was in my late 20s, and I had to give it up to get a permanent job. And now I think I want to go back to it because I quite like travelling. Not too far, but I don't think although I'm going to China at the end of the month, and that's quite an adventure. But I think that freedom, particularly travel within the UK, because I haven't really done that very much. And I think it's easy to look outside of the UK and not really know about all the treasures that are here and all the experiences you can have here.
Now, I've been living in Kent since 2004, and I've learnt more about certainly the seaside in the last few months, or certainly the last year, than I have done in the last decade.
Do you like living by the sea?
I love it. I'm now in the countryside, but I now make a particular effort on the weekend to go to Dover or Folkestone. I was living in Herne Bay, and I've got the best of both worlds now, the countryside with the sea, because we live in Kent, just sort of 20 minutes away.
I think it's because I was born by the sea that I can't be too far away from the sea, which is probably why I hated Manchester so much. There was never the feeling that over the horizon might be the sea. It would be over several horizons before you got to the sea. And I think I need to be near the sea.
Yeah. Well, this has been so enlightening. And again, I really feel, because I've known you obviously for a number of years, but I really feel that I've learned so more about you, so much more about you in the last hour. And I definitely want to, you know, once the microphone stops recording, I want to continue some of these conversations. So, Michael Hughes, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.